Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. My co-presenter, John Dorney, recently organised a series of lectures in the Teachers Club in Dublin for the People's College on the theme of Ireland's revolutionary experience of 1916 to 1923 in a world context. Here is William Mulligan's lecture, New Borders in Ireland and Europe, 1918 to 1923.
When, as we approached the decade of centenaries several years ago, it was common to talk about this period between 1912 and 1923 in Irish history as constituting a revolution, at least one that changed the political underpinnings of society on this island and its relationship with Britain. But I think one could also argue that the revolution in Ireland mirrors some of the issues which are present in Europe between 1912 and 1923. And although we often think of the First World War as starting in August 1914 and ending on Armistice Day on the 11th of November 1918, I think we can see a broader period of violence that starts with wars in the Balkans in the autumn of 1912, so around the same time as the Home Rule crisis is brewing in Ireland, and then a process of the restoration of stability, if not full peace, by the mid-1920s, by 1923, with the end of the Great Inflation in Germany, with the peace treaty between Turkey and its erstwhile enemies, and the stabilization of the Soviet Russian state, to name some examples. And these processes are intertwined with Irish history, both at a personal level and also in terms of ideas. And one figure who encapsulates this intertwining of Irish and European processes in history in this period is Michael McQuaid, whose papers are in UCD. Michael McQuaid was someone of an adventurer. He fought in the Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913 on the side of the Bulgarians with the aim of establishing a Bulgarian nation state. When the First World War broke out, he joined not the British Army, but he joined the French Foreign Legion. He then served with the French forces until the United States entered the war in 1917, at which point he undertook a mission with the French government to the United States in order to raise finance for the French war mission. At the end of the First World War in November 1918, he was decommissioned from the French army, and at that point he returned to Dublin, where he advised the new Doyle government from early 1919 on its foreign relations, and he became one of the first Irish representatives, the first Irish representative to the nascent League of Nations in Geneva in the early 1920s. And I think he would have understood, as so many other Irish people did, that what was happening in Ireland and Europe were not two separate histories, but were ones that were intertwined. That the issues in Ireland about nation and empire, whether could Ireland be both a nation and part of a greater imperial whole, as people like John Redmond had said before 1914, and indeed until their until Redmond's death in 1918, or did a nation have to have an independent state? And this was something that perplexed and challenged nationalists, not just in Ireland, but right across Europe. And I think throughout the First World War, you get a gradual shift in nationalist thinking from Czech and Polish nationalists who before 1914 are seeking a form of home rule or autonomy for their nations within the Russian or Habsburg empires, to an argument that by 1918, that the only way that a state or that a nation can be truly culturally independent is through having its own state. Now, as you created nation states, this created problems for minorities. This was a problem with which governments on both sides of what became the Free State and Northern Irish State were familiar. There was a Protestant minority, obviously, in the south, and a much larger Catholic minority in Northern Ireland. And this was a question that troubled other nations and nascent nation states throughout Europe. And so minority rights treaties were imposed on states like Poland and Romania to ensure that they treated ethnic minorities and religious minorities, such as Germans and Jews, who found themselves in the borders of these nation states in accordance with international norms. And becoming a nation or becoming a nation state also raised questions about how could a nation state defend itself. One of the arguments before 1914 against small states, and this was an argument that nationalists made as well as imperialists, was that it was virtually impossible for a small nation to defend itself against foreign aggression. That if the Czech nation state, for example, set itself up in Bohemia, it would become the target of predatory great powers of the German and the Russian empires, and the Czech nation simply did not have the size or the capacity to defend itself. Now, during the First World War, there is considerable discussion about this, particularly given that the Allies, Britain and France, argued that they were fighting the wars for the rights of small nations, for the rights of small states, such as Belgium and Serbia. But this raised the question of what kind of international architecture could be established. And Irish nationalists also considered this and saw institutions like the League of Nations, but also groups like the International Labour Organization, which was set up in the aftermath of the First World War, as institutions in which national sovereignty could be affirmed and could be guaranteed. And in other words, that this would reduce the pressure for a state to guard its borders simply through military power, but that it would be possible to guard it through norms of international law and a respect for sovereignty. And the First World War also raised issues about the relationship between civilian power and military power throughout Europe. There was, of course, martial law was declared in Ireland after 1918. The British introduced the Defence of the Realm Act on the outbreak of war in 1914. And there was intense competition between military and civilian sides of government for political dominance in this period. This occurred, of course, in Ireland, and its ultimate manifestation, I suppose, was the mutiny in 1924. But this mutiny in the Irish context also had its mirror mutinies in other places around Europe, such as, to name two examples, a failed military putsch in Germany in March 1920, and a successful military putsch in Bulgaria in 1923. So it's against that background that I want to talk about these issues and about peace and how peace was remade after the end of the First World War. And the first argument that I would make is that the notion of what constitutes peace expands over the course of the First World War. If you ask someone in 1913 or even July 1914, what did peace mean? They would largely answer the absence of fighting and stable borders. By the 1920s, peace had come to mean a much thicker set of social relationships, which involved workers' rights, women's rights, constitutional liberties, minority rights, as well as the more conventional and classic definitions of peace, which were centered on great power politics. And I think what happens during the First World War is that the expansion of the definition of peace is a result of the experience of total war. It leads people that the experience of war changes what peace means. Firstly, you have the shock of violence in 1914. Again, before 1914, Europeans, believe it or not, thought of themselves as particularly civilized and blessed. They considered them that civilization was something that allowed men, and it was mainly men, to settle their disputes through rational discussion rather than savage violence. And what 1914 showed many Europeans is that the civilizing process that they believed had changed human nature over the course of the 19th century, that this civilizing process was a mere patina, it was a very fragile achievement that could be wiped away very quickly, as it was as advancing armies committed atrocities and here we've got a picture of the sacking of Louvain, the university town in Belgium by German troops in 1914. German troops massacred about 5,000 to 6,000 French and Belgian civilians. Russian troops massacred over 1,000 German civilians on the Eastern Front, and Austro-Hungarian invading forces executed thousands of Serbians in the Balkans in 1914. So what the shock of violence did is that it forced Europeans to consider that in order to recreate peace, it also meant to recreate civilized behavior, that the way in which men have been barbarized by their experience of the war, that this barbarization process had to be undone in order to make peace. The second point I'd make about peace during the First World War is that we often think of the First World War as being a clash between great powers, that it's a traditional conflict for material resources, be it territory or economic resources. But the First World War, historians have come to view in more recent years, was not only a traditional clash between the great powers, but it was also a clash in which the great powers argued that they were fighting not merely for their own security, but that they were also fighting for certain values. And here, the British and the French governments, and later the United States, argued that they were fighting for the cause of civilization, for the rule of law, for the rights of small nations, for the principle of self-determination, for democracy. And finally, the experience of war also reconstitutes what peace meant. Is in the 19th century, the wars, or the classic wars that have been studied and that provided the model to many Europeans of what war meant, and therefore what peace meant on the eve of the First World War, were the short wars between Prussia and Austria in 1866, or between the North German Confederation and France in 1870. These were wars that had lasted a short number of months, that had not really dislocated society and the economy. But in the First World War, the experience of war delves deep into people's everyday lives. It sunders communities. It takes men out of factories, out of homes. It forces women to take up roles or to take on extra roles. It deprives children of their father, of their fathers, and mothers in some cases. And so that this experience of war leads to a redefinition of peace. It becomes something of a mockery, I suppose, to think of the First World War in the phrase of the science fiction writer H.G. Wells, that this was the war to end all wars, that this was a war fought for peace. But during the First World War, there are multiple public and private statements of war aims. Now, you're as cynical as politicians about as I am. You'd probably say that what a politician says in public has no bearing on what they say in private. But I want to suggest that, in fact, public declarations create what some political scientists have called a linguistic trap. And a good example of it, and we've referred to it here, is Woodrow Wilson's 14-point speech, which he gave to Congress in January 1918. And in this 14-point speech, he set out a number of principles and a number of war aims. Now, these war aims reflected very closely what he had said in private. Moreover, once he set out this statement, he was potentially being held to these war aims, that it became very difficult for him to justify moving away from these public declarations. And here we come to a slight twist in the story. Is Wilson, in his famous 14-point speech, never used the term national self-determination. I believe that he had, so when I read through the speech, I looked for it and looked for it and looked for it again. But I also read a memorandum by his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing. Now, Lansing was a man who despised Wilson. Lansing was saw himself as a man of the world. He was a lawyer. He resented Wilson's idealism. He also resented Wilson's success in winning the presidency twice. But Lansing woke up on the morning of the 9th of January 1918, and he used to write these memos on what had happened the day before. And in this memo, he said, "I cannot believe that Woodrow Wilson yesterday promised self-determination to the world." Wilson had not used this term at all, but yet this is what Lansing had heard. And this is precisely the terms that people had heard around the world. So although Wilson never used the term, people attributed that term to him. And there was also nationalists here in Ireland, Arthur Griffith and others, listened very closely to Woodrow Wilson's speech and used that as a justification for their claims for Irish independence. And interestingly, because it's been overshadowed by Woodrow Wilson's speech, is Lloyd George had given a speech 3 days previously at Caxton Hall in London, where he had made very similar speech to Wilson, and he had used the term national self-determination. And this was again taken up by Irish nationalists and said, "The British Prime Minister has promised the principle of national self-determination, therefore, why won't he apply it to the Irish context?" And this was something to which they held Woodrow Wilson during and after the First World War. So these visions of war aims, as I said, went beyond the territorial. They moved into the ideological. They even went into the sense of what I say is remaking moral communities. That what did it mean to be European? How could you make peace again? And it also went to the remaking of the fabric of everyday life. And I'll give two quick examples of what I mean by this. One is from a very well-known French author, Georges Duhamel. Duhamel was a pacifist, so when he was called up, he volunteered to serve as a stretcher bearer. And he wrote to his wife, Blanche, almost every day throughout the 4 years that he spent on the Western Front. Now, in late 1916, Woodrow Wilson and the German Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, launched two separate peace initiatives. And Georges Duhamel, writing to his wife Blanche, said, "Peace is in the air. I can't wait for peace to be restored so that we can spend Christmas together." For Duhamel, peace meant not the redrawing of borders, not the imposition of reparations payment on victor or vanquished. Rather, peace meant the recreation of family life. And a second example was a friend of mine whose great-grandfather served during the First World War, and he kept a diary of his military service and went through it and starts in 1914, goes through November 1918, and it ended in March 1919 when he arrived back in Victoria Station and he met his beloved, as he called her, and got in a cab. And then he wrote the final words in diary, "And the rest nobody needs to know." In other words, he kept this diary of his wartime experiences for his wife so that she would know what he had gone through. But it's for him, the war stopped at the moment that he cast eyes on his wife in Victoria Station in London when he was demobilized, rather than on the 11th of November 1918. Now, that's those were the visions of peace that were set out during the First World War, and as I say about American presidential elections, you campaign in poetry, but you have to rule in prose. And so one of the difficulties for peacemakers after 1918 was calibrating or bringing together these different visions of peace to remake a stable world. And this was something that they sought to do in Paris in a series of peace treaties between the Allies and the defeated states, that is Germany, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Turkey. So these were settlements that they came to in 1919 and 1920, and a few categories here. The first and perhaps the most significant issue was the geographical settlement, and I'll just skip on briefly to the next slide. So Wilson had not used the term national self-determination, but by the time he arrived in Paris in early 1919, the term national self-determination had arisen to be perhaps the primary principle that people believed would underpin the peace settlement. And so this meant that delegates, both from states but also from national groups, including Irish delegates, gathered in Paris in order to petition the Allies for their claims for a nation state. Now, on one level, the claims of national self-determination were honoured in the breach, and we have numerous examples of this here in Sudetenland, in what would it be northwest. Czechoslovakia, there was a large German majority living, the so-called Sudeten Germans, whom Hitler exploited in the late 1930s with a view to annexing Czechoslovakia. There was also a German majorities in western Poland, in southern Denmark, and even here in Alsace and Lorraine, which Germany had annexed from France in after the war in 1870-71, there was probably a majority of German-speaking inhabitants in Alsace and Lorraine, but hundreds of thousands of them were expelled by the French government at the end of the First World War. So, with a view to justifying the French claims to these territories on the grounds of national self-determination. And minorities in other parts of Europe as well. So what, and we have the violation, I should say, of national self-determination in the drawing of the border between the Irish Free State and Northern Ireland, where two of the counties had a Catholic majority, but were of course included in the Northern Irish state. Now, the Northern Ireland example and the Border Commission can actually give us a good insight into the principles which underpinned the European settlement, because it was clear to delegates at the Boundary Commission in the 1920s that on the principles of national self-determination, that these two, that two counties should be included in the Irish Free State. But the Unionists made the argument that if they were deprived of these two counties, Northern Ireland would become too small, that it would effectively be wouldn't be a viable state. So that in order for a state to be viable, it needed to tweak or to ignore at certain points the principle of national self-determination. And there was really two grounds that it was violated upon. Firstly, there was the strategic argument that a state needed a certain piece of territory in order to defend itself against future aggression. And that happens here in northern Italy. And another variety of the argument was that a state needed a certain territory because it was integrated into that state's economy, or was essential to giving that state a balanced economy. And that was part of the argument that was made in favour of the inclusion of the Sudetenland within Czechoslovakia, that it was the richest and most vibrant industrial area in Czechoslovakia, and therefore it needed to be included in the Czechoslovak state, although there were a majority of Germans living in that area. And the final example and the compromise is this area here, the Free City of Danzig, where again there was a majority of Germans, but the Polish government argued that in order to be a viable state, Poland needed access to the sea so that it could export independently of having to go through another country. And so the Free City of Danzig was put under the control of the League of Nations, and I think Sean Lester, an Irishman, was commissioner there in the 1930s. So this principle of national self-determination was violated on the grounds of economic and a strategic viability. Now, I would caution against saying that this means that the principle of national self-determination was completely disregarded, because if you disregarded the principle of national self-determination completely, then arguably you would have had no Irish Free State whatsoever, that Germany could have been broken back into its constituent elements dating back to 1870, so that rather than having a German state after the First World War, it would have been broken into an independent Bavarian state, an independent Rhineland, and so on. And these plans, I should say, were very much discussed. There were debates amongst the Fichte states, particularly the French government. There was strong pressure from certain right-wing French nationalists and the military to break Germany into these constituent into its constituent pieces that had existed before 1870. But even the French premier Clemenceau, who had been no friend of Germany during the First World War, argued that this would be such an egregious violation of the principle of national self-determination that it wouldn't find acceptance with their British and French allies. And I think in the case of Ireland, it also has an importance in putting pressure on Lloyd George putting pressure even on the Conservatives in 1921 to grant a free state settlement to Ireland. Not because the Conservative leaders had any, which then the majority of Lloyd George's cabinet, any great affection for Irish nationalism. No, they hadn't. But because they understood that to violate the principle of national self-determination would place Britain in a very awkward relationship with the United States, where American liberals, not Irish Americans, but American liberals, had made Britain's treatment of Ireland a test case for Britain's claims to be a civilized, liberal, democratic country. The other terms were the financial and military terms of the treaty can be summed up briefly, although they're fairly complex. The Fichters imposed a large reparation settlement, not just in Germany, but also in Austria, Bulgaria, and on Hungary. It bankrupted Bulgaria and it destroyed a democratic government in Bulgaria under the peasant leader Stambolivski in 1922-1923. And it created problems for the nascent democratic regime in Germany. And in military terms, there was a hefty disarmament clauses which restricted the size of the German army to 100,000 men who had to serve for a minimum of 12 years. And the idea was that because they had to serve for a minimum of 12 years, you couldn't kind of train a soldier up, ship him out after 6 months or a year, and then bring others in. So the idea was to weaken Germany militarily and economically. Now, at the same time, there's also innovations in the Paris peace settlement for the development of international institutions, most notably the League of Nations, but also the International Labour Organization. The League of Nations is an association, or is an institution, that is often associated with failure. It was an institution which De Valera, amongst others, criticized with considerable justification in the 1930s for its failure to intervene and to resolve conflicts such as the Italian invasion of Abyssinia. But it's an institution that historians more recently have argued had some purpose and offered a framework for the establishment of peace. It had a general assembly, and it enshrined this idea that all states were legally sovereign and equal. So what the League of Nations was an attempt to do was an attempt to move away from the principle of a great power order in which some states are sovereign but more equal than others on the grounds of their military and economic capacity, to a conception of the international order in which all states are legally sovereign and legally equal. However, at its inception, it was hamstrung by the denial of German membership, the exclusion of Soviet Russia, and the decision of the United States, the American Senate, to reject membership of the League of Nations and reject the Treaty of Versailles in the autumn of 1919. The International Labour Organization was also established in 1919, and this reflected demands by trade unionists on both the Allied and the Central Power side during the First World War, that a peace settlement must reflect not just the interests of the diplomatic and political elites, but also had to recognize the interests of workers. And one of the arguments that trade unionists put forward during the First World War was that the outbreak of war in 1914 was the result of economic competition between states and between countries before 1914, which had led to a form of a race to the bottom in which the interests of workers had been sacrificed as wages were restricted, welfare was limited, and so on. Now, the International Labour Organization was established. It had trade union representation. Trade unionists played an important role in getting it on the agenda in Paris in 1919, and was also, incidentally, the first international organization to include Germany after the First World War. Now, one of the reasons for this was that trade unionists in France, Britain, and the United States were concerned that if Germany was excluded from the International Labour Organization, then Germany could ignore certain norms about welfare and working conditions. So it was in part of the interest was to avoid this kind of race to the bottom. The International Labour Organization functioned really by establishing sets of norms, and it really tried to shame countries into adopting and implementing legislation. It didn't have strong executive powers, and although again we can see numerous violations of these norms, and countries are slow, were slow to implement agreements, as they're slow to implement EU directives, it did have an impact, so that something like the 8-hour working day becomes a norm of labour regulations. There's a ban on children and women working at certain times. There is an introduction of international standards for health and safety.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong way.
One of the things about thinking about peace after the First World War is that peace was not just something that was signed and then is implemented. Peace is not just a moment in time. Peace is rather a process. And here I think we often think about war as something that people do, and peace that's a kind of a default position. But you could argue that peace is a set of social and political relationships that needs to be renewed and practiced almost on a daily basis in order for it to succeed. But the first effort to introduce peace in Europe between 1919 and 1923 is really characterized But by failure, the last point here is that the experience of peace was in some cases not very different to the experience of war. My colleague Robert Gerhardt has charted how after 1919 there continued to be wars right throughout Europe. In Russia, around 5 million people died in the Russian civil wars. In wars between Turkey and Greece, there continued to be ethnic cleansing that culminated in the transfer, forced population transfer of 1 million citizens in 1922 and 1923. In Finland, which is a similar population to Ireland, there was a brutal civil war following the end of the First World War, in which 40,000 people, so 1% of its population, died. Which is, yeah, comparing the Irish context, I think it's 4,000 people. So is it the kind of death
rate? For the whole period.
For the Civil War.
Well, the Civil War itself is probably about 2, and then the whole period about 4,000.
4,000, yes. Yeah. So it's so that'll give you kind of some scale of the conflict. Or, and his point is that although an armistice is signed in November 1918, and then a peace treaty is signed in June 1919, is that peace doesn't really come to Europe in these years between 1919 and 1923, and in that context the Irish experience also matches up the experience of other Europeans. And even in those areas where there's no killing, the conditions for daily life were often very difficult. There is a the extraction of reparations, for instance, put German workers in coal mines and other industries in Western Germany in very difficult working conditions, which led to ill health, a spike in mortality. There was military occupations throughout Europe, which often spilled over into low-level violence. And here we have a picture of the French occupation of the Ruhr, the main industrial region in Western Germany in 1923, when they executed a number of German civilians and workers who protested against the occupation. One French soldier, Lieutenant Cochin, was killed by a German paramilitary or terrorist group, and his family had suffered at the hands of German invaders in 1914, and so his personal fate was again held up as being a kind of part of this intertwining of a story. In other words, that the people felt that the war had not come to an end in 1918 or 1919, that it continued. And so this has led some historians, but it led people at the time to talk about what one French priest, Abbé Pradal, called moral disarmament, and he argued that in order to restore peace, what was required was not just a cessation of shooting at each other, but was actually a recalibration of these wartime cultures. Cultures of hate now had to be recast into a different guise. And here we have one person who's emblematic of this change is a French character, Pierre Fionneau. Fionneau was a young student, and in July 1914, at the outbreak of the First World War, he was cycling through Germany with some friends, and he arrived in a beer garden on the banks of the River Rhine on the 31st of July 1914. He ordered a beer. He noticed that there was a lot of very nationalistic songs being sung. He decided that he better stand up and join in these songs if he didn't want to receive a beating. Next day he departed for France, and he signed up in the French army. He volunteered, so he was not someone who was conscripted into the French army, but he volunteered, and partly because he believed that the French cause was just, that Germany was a threat not just to French security, but Germany was a threat to the values of civilization and republican democracy. Fionneau was injured, I think, at the Battle of the Somme, yes, in which the French suffered more casualties than the British, incidentally. He was injured at the Battle of Somme in 1916, and then he was addicted to cocaine and morphine. He was given a kind of a lifeline when he was sent to Morocco, where he worked for a French general. But then in the early 1920s, he returned to Europe, and he fell in with a Luxembourg steel magnate, as it would happen. This Luxembourg steel magnate, Jules Marsh, funded a program of educational links between French and German students and school children. And Fionneau was the person who came up with this idea. His argument was that peace could only be restored not by putting two states in contact or two governments in contact with one another, but by putting two societies in contact with one another. And it was at that point that his story about having witnessed the outbreak of the First World War in Germany in 1914 became important, because he believed that it was a lack of knowledge between two societies that had generated the aggressive rabid nationalism of the First World Wars, and that in order to discount this, these societies needed to encounter one another. And this happened throughout Europe by the mid-1920s, is that there's a whole panoply of exchanges and networks, churches, trade union groups, women's groups, who send delegations to each other with a view really to getting to know each other at a social level. And what part of this is it's about remaking the meaning of the war and the meaning of peace. And I'll give one example of that is there's a group called the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which was set up by American pacifists during the First World War. And in the early 1920s, they held a number of ceremonies. And one of the ceremonies brought together a French mother, I think, so the mother of a French soldier and the wife of a German soldier. And they met each other on a stage. It was all fairly carefully kind of choreographed, but they met each other on the stage and they exchanged roses and they cast themselves and they said, "I am no longer a French woman, I am no longer a German woman, I am a mother, I am a wife." In other words, they recast the war not as a conflict between nations that hated each other, but rather as a tragedy that affected people in their personal lives. And in this way, same thing happened with trade unions or with the Catholic Church. They recast the conflict, as I said, as a tragedy, and that inspired them to learn the lessons from the war. In other words, that the period after the war should not be a continuation of the war by other means, but it should be an effort to learn from the conflict to restore peace. And this peace, I would argue, really came to fruition in the mid-1920s, really as a result of various factors, but including domestic political change in the three crucial powers, Germany, France, and Britain. In Germany, Gustav Stresemann came to power as Chancellor in 1923 and then Foreign Minister. Stresemann had been a rabid, aggressive nationalist during the First World War, but by 1922, 1923, he argued that Germany's future lay not in conflict with France and Britain, but rather in cooperation with these countries. He argued that the economic costs of war were too high, and the German power really lay not in its military might, but rather in its economic power, and its power to trade with other countries. In Britain, the Labour government, the first Labour government, came to power under Ramsay MacDonald, and Ramsay MacDonald, although he didn't see it through, instituted a change in British foreign policy towards a more internationalist stance. And a similar process happened in France in 1924 and 1925, when the left-leaning, I can't remember his party, but left-leaning mayor of Lyon, Edouard Herriot, became prime minister. And together, the French, German, and British leaders, between 1924 and 1926, put in place an institutional framework, if you like, that superseded the peace settlement of 1919, but also offered a framework for future peace. The Dawes Plan effectively tried to settle the reparations issue by setting the amount that Germany would have to pay and setting that amount against German economic performance. The Treaty of Locarno guaranteed borders in Western Europe, though significantly not in Eastern Europe, so that neither the Germans nor the French nor the Belgians would have to fear invasion from each other. And in 1926, Germany entered the League of Nations, which began a part of the process of transforming the League of Nations from a victors' club into an international organization that could seek to restore security and could manage international problems throughout the first, or throughout, at least throughout Europe. Now, I wrote a book called The Great War for Peace, and part of my argument was that the First World War changed what peace meant, and that it's and that by the mid-1920s, some form of stable peace had been established in Europe. And I think something similar happens again in the Irish context. It is interesting here that we've the end of the Civil War in 1923, the failure of the army mutiny in 1924 establishes the primacy of civilian government in Ireland. And the obvious response to my argument, and one that reviewers made, is that it's looking at this through rose-tinted glasses, and what about the Second World War? You know, how could this be a peace, some form of stable peace by the mid-1920s if just 14 years later, 14 years after the Treaty of Locarno in 1925 and 1939, we have the outbreak of a second global war. And it's certainly an incomplete peace in 1925, 1926. There's still geopolitical tensions. While borders have been guaranteed in the west of Europe, borders remain open and contested in the east. Disarmament is incomplete. Germany had disarmed by the mid-1920s, but German disarmament in the Treaty of Versailles was meant to be followed by British and French disarmament, which never happened. There were certainly financial weaknesses to the peace settlement after 1919 and even in the mid-1920s, in that a lot of the payments that Germany was able to make depended on the vibrancy of the American economy. And once the American economy tanked in 1929, the depression in Europe upended the economical underpinning of peace. And social peace was also limited. While families were put back together, while there were these networks established between academics, trade unionists, priests, students, and so on throughout Europe after 1919, communities were still rent asunder by the legacy of war. Large parts of northern France remained destroyed, and even in a very basic but very important part of everyday life, veterans had, for instance, had much higher rates of alcoholism and divorce, relationship breakdown, than other social groups. So in that sense, the promise of social peace that had been held out during the First World War was also incomplete. And yet, I finish on this point, is that if we think of peace as a process, as something that that isn't just a line in the sand, then it's something that's ongoing. It's something that has to be renewed on a continual basis. And to argue that the peace was incomplete by 1925 does not mean that that peace was absolutely doomed. I would argue that the institutions that were established by the mid-1920s gave a framework which could have achieved a more enduring settlement had it not been for the Great Depression that hit Europe, hit the world economy in 1929. So in this context, the key turning point on the road from the First World War to the Second World War is not a flawed Treaty of Versailles. Rather, it is the Great Depression and the upending of globalization. And a second point related to that is that many of these ideas that were tried out, such as the League of Nations, the International Labour Organization, even things like student exchanges, these were tried out in the period after the First World War, but then they're renewed in the period after the Second World War. And the fathers of the European Union, people like Jean Monnet, Konrad Adenauer, Alcide De Gasperi, the Italian leader, even Harold Macmillan, the British leader, who's the first British Prime Minister to apply for entry to the European Union. These were men whose worldviews had not just been formed by the Second World War, these were men whose worldviews had been formed by the First World War. Jean Monnet had played an important part in the logistics of the war effort and then the League of Nations. Konrad Adenauer had been mayor of Cologne between 1917 and 1933 and had witnessed the occupation of Western Germany at the end of the First World War. Harold Macmillan had fought in the trenches in the First World War and had always abhorred violence after escaping with his life. One of his best friends was castrated, other friends died. These were men who were scarred by the experience of war, not between 1939 and 1945, but the war between 1914 and 1918. And these were men that sought to learn the lessons, not just of the Second World War, but of the incomplete peace that they had tried, that they and their political seniors had tried to establish after 1919. And one final, I suppose, point to make about it is that, to come back to the Irish context, is that in the Irish context is that the peace that was established on this island was actually relatively enduring. And I don't know, one of the first Irish history books I read was Joseph Lee's Ireland 1912 to 1985, and read it in the 1980s when I was kind of told at school, you know, learn French, learn German, because you'll never get a job in Ireland. It was a story of severe failure by Irish society and by the Irish state in particular. But when I think about Ireland in the context of European history between in the interwar period, I think that Ireland mirrors what goes on in Europe, but that actually it represents a tremendous success story. The ability of the Irish state to control its military wing after a very violent civil war, the survival of democracy, general respect, albeit violated on occasion, for the rights of minorities and the membership of international organizations like the League of Nations. And so to that extent, while in economic terms, certainly Irish history in the first half of the 20th century or even beyond that left much to be desired, in terms of these political achievements, there were important and enduring ones that can be seen better within the framework of a European history. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please visit our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/the Irish History Show. And we really appreciate all the support from all the people who are listening. If you want to share any of the episodes with your friends on social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything like that, we really appreciate it too. Thank you.